Please include the worldwide outreach of issues, etc. in your year-end giving. With 1 month left in 2020, we're $160,000 short of projected expenses. You can make a secure online gift at issuesetc.org. You can also make a year-end tax-deductible donation by check. Make your check payable to Issues Etc. and send it to Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Thanks for listening, and thanks for keeping us in mind at the end of the year.
Why rule on a case that is moot and come up with a different decision than you did several months ago on the same issue? You have a different court. And I think that was the statement that the court was making.
That's New York Governor Andrew Cuomo reacting to the Supreme Court's ruling on COVID-19 restrictions, his COVID-19 restrictions on religious gatherings. The court went against him. He says, well, it's a different court. That's all you really need to know. Glossing over some real issues of religious liberty and free exercise. Maybe it isn't just that we have a different court. Maybe it's a different time. We know a little bit more. And maybe we are valuing religious liberty or being put in a position where we can either decide to value it or not. Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. live on this Wednesday afternoon, December the 2nd. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're going to be talking about a New York Times coverage of the Supreme Court's ruling against the New York Governor Andrew Cuomo's restrictions on religious gatherings. Terry Mattingly will be our guest. A little later, Dr. R.J. Snell, Director of Academic Programs at the Witherspoon Institute, joins us to talk about both the relativism and the dogmatism of progressive social justice movements. Then the dangers of school closing with Lauren Fink, author of a column for National Review Online titled The COVID Kids. And then finally, we'll round everything off today, having a conversation with Cardinal Raymond Burke about Pope Francis's reported comments on same-sex civil unions. Joining us to discuss media coverage of the Supreme Court's ruling against New York Governor Andrew Cuomo's restrictions on religious gatherings, Terry Mattingly. He's senior fellow at the Overby Center at the University of Mississippi. He is author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and the book Pop Goes Religion, and he's founder and editor of Get Religion. Terry, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
Is this perhaps a rare example of liberals realizing that religious liberty is still a liberal cause?
I think you can see that in some of the coverage, but not all of it. In particular, I was absolutely flabbergasted to pop open my computer and read an op-ed page piece at the New York Times. Yes, the much-discussed, totally woke op-ed pages of the New York Times. They ran, frankly, an excellent piece on why the court did what it did. And they even kind of paused to comment on the media coverage, which is, in a way, this was a chance to compare apples and apples, or apples and, well, I meant apples to apples because it's both in the New York Times. But you're doing with an op-ed page piece versus their own media coverage. Now, frankly, the news coverage at the Times wasn't that bad. And it wasn't bad, especially in comparison to what I saw in other publications and, man, my goodness gracious, what was on Twitter. On Twitter, this entire story was, of course, Amy Coney Barrett. And people were going so far that was that she was violating her Catholic pro-life beliefs by passing signing off and being the swing vote in this 5-4 decision that was going to kill thousands of Americans when this thing hit other parts of the country. I believe I remember a tweet about Amy Coney Barrett having blood on her hands because of this decision, all of which has little or nothing to do with what the court actually said, you know, in this decision. So after the New York Times news piece basically did a milder version of what a lot of people did. It starts with the Supreme Court, banned restrictions, da-da-da. The vote was 5-4 with Chief Justice Roberts and the court's three liberal members in dissent. The order was the first in which the court's newest member, Justice Amy Coney Barrett, played a decisive role. And it talked about reversing the Nevada case. Now, The problem and the op-ed page piece, the opinion piece by two lawyers, one with who teaches at New York University, at least part-time, it has a paragraph which I think our listeners really need to hear, because to some degree this is the summary of the media critique, except here's this media critique being run in the op-ed page of the New York Times, which gives it some more clout, especially on the left, and maybe will wake up some of what we like to call at Crossroads the old left, the actual liberals who really care about the First Amendment. The third paragraph of the piece says, "Politics is a distorted lens for understanding the case. Looking at the substance, six justices agreed that the free exercise clause was probably violated by the governor's order. The restrictions, which are far more draconian than those approved by the court in the earlier cases, are both extraordinarily tight and essentially unexplained." It talks about the New York City's red zones, where infection rates are the highest. Worship is limited to 10 persons, no matter how large the facility. Now, here's an image that could have been great in any story. Whether dealing with St. Patrick's Cathedral, seating capacity 2,500, or a tiny shul in Brooklyn. Because the Orthodox Jewish services require a quorum, a minyan, of 10 adult men, this is an effective prohibition on the ability of Orthodox women to attend worship services. Now, that's really good writing, and it really does pare this down to the fact that from the very beginning of the coronavirus crisis, the main issue in news coverage has been focusing on the number, the relatively small number of religious organizations, churches, etc., who rebelled against efforts to stop the virus versus the overwhelming majority who cooperated. In this case, if you look at it in the New York context, you're focusing on headlines about ultra-Orthodox Jews having a 1,000-person wedding versus the reality of what's happening in the congregations that are directly affected by this law. And try to imagine the logic of saying that you can have the same number of worshipers in a cathedral that seats 2,500 versus a small Korean Presbyterian congregation in Brooklyn that maybe has room in rented facilities for 50. But both of those rooms, it's safe to have only 10 people. So what we missed here again is that all kinds of bishops and congregational leaders and denominational leaders, the Southern Baptist Convention and all this, all kinds of people worked with the regulations in trying to develop a way for people to go back to worship wearing masks and in a socially distant situation that fit the CDC guidelines. But then occasionally along would come these lightning strike laws and regulations from certain governments, which completely ignored whether people were trying to be safe and trying to do anything nuanced, and just said, nope, you get 10 people, or nope, you get 25 people. Meanwhile, in Nevada, casinos, sky's the limit. Big box stores, that's fine. Your local gym, that's fine. What we saw was a tendency again, a kind of illiberalism that seems to think that religious activity is uniquely dangerous and that the free exercise of religion is somehow a less, that big word now, less essential service to human beings than going to Walmart or going to Target or going to, or for that matter, taking part in a civil rights march with thousands of other people jammed into a city block near the White House or something like that.
I was also intrigued by the story in the New York Times that ran earlier. It was titled "Splitting 5-4, Supreme Court Backs Religious Challenge to Cuomo's Virus Shutdown Order." And I was pleasantly surprised to see that rather than simply noting that Chief Justice Roberts voted with the minority, they actually quoted the salient part of his dissent, where he essentially said, you know, I don't disagree with the majority. I just think it's not time yet to do this because, quote, by that time, Cuomo had already kind of pulled his cards off the table.
And then you looked at some of the sniping that went back and forth within the court. I believe it was from Gorsuch and the Chief Justice, where they took some shots at each other. I really think that there were divisions in the court about the Nevada case that were still bubbling and overflowing. We talked the other day about the speech that Justice Alito gave to the Federalist Society, and I wrote about that. Alito was clearly ticked off by the Nevada decision. And this whole idea of casinos being essential but churches aren't was still it was still stewing in his mind and in the minds of some other people on the, quote, conservative side of the court. And, of course, there's the irony again. The conservative side of the court is the one that's defending what 20 years ago was liberalism, which would be a strong defense of religious liberty and erring on the side of allowing religious participation. I think you and I have also talked through the years about the fact that in church-state law, if you're going to limit the freedom of religious groups, you're allowed to go after three basic conditions: profit, fraud, and then the tricky one, clear threat to life and health. Well, obviously, in all of the media coverage and the arguments about the coronavirus, the clear threat to life and health is what we're talking about here. The issue is why some governments, and I can't stress too much the word some, like the cases in Louisville and several others, why did some government officials, especially in big urban areas, decided that they needed to have stricter regulations affecting religious practice than affecting other First Amendment rights of assembly, speech, freedom of association, etc.? Why be tougher on religious groups than on other activities that kind of look the same? I really liked the opinion pieces stress on the, you know, the fact that if you're in a big box store, I mean, that's Home Depot on a Saturday. It says customers are not the only members of the public that matter. The workers at stores and factories are exposed to every single customer and coworker who enters, and they remain for an entire workday in the same indoor space, often not effectively socially distanced. They may not sing like churches, but they have been known to laugh, shout, or yell. And now a lot of yelling goes on in casinos, and a lot of yelling goes on at demonstrations. The question has been consistency of application of government laws and regulations, not whether churches, synagogues, cathedrals, choirs, etc., needed to be careful. What gets lost in the coverage again, and I know I keep stressing this, but it's so important, is it's a big story that the vast majority of religious organizations have done everything they can to cooperate with CDC guidelines and try to get back to in-person worship while meeting the standards of social distancing, masking, and safety. I think of this, you know, whenever I'm at my own Orthodox church, where we receive communion, Holy Communion in the service of Divine Liturgy, in a spoon, and we receive the bread and the wine at the same time in a small golden or silver spoon. When we were in stage one, when we first began to come back together, our bishop told us that we needed to have like 10 to a dozen spoons. And after each person received communion, the individual spoon was wiped down with a sanitary wipe and then put into a container of like 100% alcohol. I mean, basically Everclear. I mean, and this was really, really strict ways to try to do communion while violating none of our canon laws, but at the same time doing everything possible to show the government that Orthodox churches were willing to cooperate in terms of preventing the spread of this disease. We still only have four singers who stand at music stands at the front of the congregation, facing away from the congregation, and they're the only people in the church, other than the clergy behind the iconostasis, who are not wearing masks, and they're singing into open air, singing forward, and they're the only people who don't have masks on when we're meeting inside the sanctuary. When we're outdoors, everybody spreads out like crazy, and not everybody is choosing to wear masks. But once again, that's following the CDC guidelines for outdoor events. I could go on about this. But we see so many of the themes that you and I have talked about over the last 8 months or so repeated in this instance. And it was so wonderful to see an editorial piece in the New York Times that finally seems to get what the big ideas are in this case.
Terry Mattingly is our guest. We're talking with him about the New York Times coverage of the Supreme Court's ruling against New York Governor Andrew Cuomo's restrictions on worship gatherings. Stay tuned. Please include the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. in your year-end giving. With 1 month left in 2020, we're $160,000 short of projected expenses. You can make a secure online gift at issuesetc.org. You can also make a year-end tax-deductible donation by check. Make your check payable to Issues Etc. and send it to Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Thanks for listening, and thanks for keeping us in mind at the end of the year.
This is Jeff Schwarz, General Manager of Lutheran Public Radio, with a message for listeners in the Mountain and Pacific time zones. We pledge to have Issues Etc. podcasts posted daily, no later than 5 p.m. Mountain, 4 p.m. Pacific. This will allow you to download and listen to the latest Issues Etc. podcast weekdays during your evening commute. Again, if you live in the Mountain or Pacific time zone, download Issues Etc. before you leave work and listen during your drive home.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
For nearly 140 years, the Lutheran Witness has taught the faith, defended it against error, and shown forth the great treasures of the Lutheran Church and biblical doctrine. We're continuing this legacy by publishing issues and articles that help you see the world from a Lutheran perspective and that teach biblical doctrine and show forth the treasures of God's Word. Visit our website to learn more and how to subscribe, witness.lcms.org. The Lutheran Witness, helping you interpret the world from a Lutheran perspective.
Do you want your neighbors and community to see what you're celebrating this Christmas season? Why not display an outdoor nativity in front of your home or church? It's a great way to show others what Christmas is all about, the birth of our Savior, Jesus Christ. Check out the Outdoor Nativity Store at outdoornativitystore.com. Durable, affordable, and American-made nativities. OutdoorNativityStore.com. OutdoorNativityStore.com.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about the New York Times coverage of the Supreme Court's ruling against New York Governor Andrew Cuomo's restrictions on worship gatherings. Terry Mattingly is our guest. He's senior fellow at the Overby Center at the University of Mississippi, author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and the book Pop Goes Religion, and founder and editor of Get Religion. So, Terry, the first story I saw this morning was about a swingers convention in New Orleans. Okay, so these are people who share spouses with one another sexually. I didn't even know they had such things. I'm so closeted and naive. And normally it attracts over 2,000 people. This time they kept it to 250 people. And as a result, there have been 40 confirmed coronavirus contacts out of this. Now, if I was rewriting the headline, I'd just write, duh. That would just be my headline. You go to New Orleans for these kind of purposes, expect to get coronavirus and some other diseases as well. Have you seen anyone who has said, okay, stores may be dangerous, indoor restaurants may be dangerous, and then in the list, houses of worship, why they are dangerous, or the numbers on the spread via houses of worship?
Well, there's no question that early on there were some super spreader events, specifically at funerals and several other cases. And you can't stress this too much. Those individual stories were valid. They were tragic and they were important, but they represented a very small percentage of the cases. By the way, you may remember if you flash all the way back to March and April, the media seemed uncomfortable with the fact that many of these events were taking place, in African-American churches, which I think made some uncomfortable. The Church of God in Christ, the massive African-American Pentecostal denomination, was hit hard, for example. But all of those kinds of nuances got lost. In the last week or two, I've been interested in reading as we learn more and more about the disease and how it spread. It really does seem that the evidence that's emerging is that shopping activities, lots of people in these big stores moving around, and the fact that lots of people are not taking masking and social distancing very carefully, that seems to be the big issue. In my own life, I also will admit that a couple of times we decided to go out to eat, and let's just put it bluntly, there are restaurants that are taking social distancing very seriously. There are others that don't seem to care at all about social distancing and whether or not they're attempting to be safe. A friend of mine, a dear friend of mine here in Oak Ridge, a couple of days ago, he posted on Facebook. He came back from going to the grocery store, and he was just livid. And I happened to be in the same store on the same day, and he was absolutely right. There were members of the staff walking around without masks or with masks just over their mouth, or, you know, that funny thing where they wear the mask just like over their chin, you know, as if their chin was spreading the virus as opposed to their mouth and their nose. And lots of customers who were entering the store without masks at all, despite the fact that there were clear signs posted that this was an environment in which customers and staff were required to wear masks. And I asked someone as we were, you know, bagging up our groceries and getting ready to go, I asked someone, what are you allowed to do with the people who are not wearing masks? And the staff member just kind of in a hushed voice said, we're not allowed to talk to them at all. We're not allowed to discuss it. We're not allowed to mention it. We're not allowed to bother them. And 4 days later, my friend was confirmed positive with COVID. And his wife is a school teacher, which means she has now had to leave the classroom and go into quarantine. She has not tested positive at this point. Now, why do I mention this? Because the evidence is that the vast majority of religious organizations have been very specific about masks, very specific about hand sanitizer, and have done what they can. We're back to this old story. What's news? Is news the few people who rebel or the overwhelming majority of people who move heaven and earth in which to cooperate? What the court was saying here is not that people didn't need regulations and not that strict regulations in some cases might not apply. But as the op-ed page piece in the New York Times said, the whole question is whether government officials are going to be rational about this and are going to explain their actions and are going to have some sort of logic that applies equally to religious and secular activities, when, of course, the irony is that the religious practice issues are uniquely protected. The piece toward the end says, perhaps Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Breyer believed that Governor Cuomo and government officials around the country will read the court's opinions and recognize that it's time to bury the meat cleaver and begin to regulate constitutional freedoms with a scalpel, without the need for a judicial order. That captures the flavor of what this whole thing has been about. Some government officials have just not granted religious worship any kind of respect that they clearly hold for limited attendance at football games, at casinos, big box stores, marches down Main Street, protesting on civil rights issues, and a host of other things. And the press coverage has not helped, because the press coverage has, as always, has focused on this as if this was a battle between Donald Trump and his justices and rational people.
So have you seen any coverage of how Governor Cuomo tried to play this? Because let's just be honest, between Governor Cuomo and Bill de Blasio, there's a lot of animus, especially with the Jewish community in certain boroughs of New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And there's open hostility on both sides here.
Yep.
And have you seen any coverage of how or why that particular confrontation has come to the fore?
Well, I mean, extreme forms of religion are always going to raise questions. And in the Orthodox community, maybe we should say the ultra-Orthodox community of Brooklyn and others, you do have people who trust God more than they trust the mayor, if you looked at it from this perspective, or the governor. And you do have people who are flaunting their willingness to obey regulations and the guidelines. The question is whether their activities need to lead to regulations that then apply to the entire world of religious worship. Whether the extreme cases lead to laws that then discriminate against everybody, as opposed to working with the many rabbis, the many bishops, and the many pastors and denominational leaders who would like to sit down and figure out what rational limitation and guidelines would look like. And I can't stress too much, there are parts of the country where those dialogues are occurring, and there's parts of the country where they're working. For some reason, a couple of large cities, and New York does get its share of ink, these conflicts in New York between these long simmering conflicts, as you implied, have shaped the whole discussion. I also believe that there's tensions within the last couple of years by the fact that there has been an increase in violence against the ultra-Orthodox in New York City. Maybe you've seen the YouTubes of people just being attacked on the street. I mean, elderly men walking down the sidewalk just being beaten up by young men. And there's racial tensions linked to this, ongoing racial tensions between some segments of the African-American community and the ultra-Orthodox Jews. And that's led to tensions that already existed in New York involving the ultra-Orthodox. That these tensions existed before COVID hit. COVID has only made the tensions, has poured gasoline on the flames. And that gasoline seems to have inspired some of these regulations instead of maybe sitting down, finding out what religious leaders wanted to work with you, and coming up with what the court would consider rational, finely crafted, reasonable restrictions on religion that look like the restrictions you then place on other activities.
So you said at the outset that you were surprised to see this op-ed piece on the pages of the New York Times. First of all, just for those who might not know, why were you surprised, especially given the very recent history of the New York Times? And do you think it might indicate at least a possibility that the op-ed pages of that once esteemed newspaper might regain some balance?
I don't know. I'm not holding my breath on that. I think in this case, I mean, the fact that you had some strong voices step forward and note problems with errors of fact or errors of balance, they listened in this case. The paragraph that most struck me as something where maybe there might be editors in the newsroom, not the op-ed page section, but the newsroom, may read that paragraph that said, looking at these events through a strictly political lens is not the way we should be dealing with First Amendment freedoms. That at some point, we may need to find out that there are people on the left and the right who both support the First Amendment. The final paragraph of that piece was, "The message is lost if the case is seen as the mere product of Justice Amy Coney Barrett's arrival at the Supreme Court. With the presidential election behind us, the balance between COVID-19 precautions and civil liberties no longer needs to be a partisan issue. The right to exercise religion in accordance with conscience is one of the most important in the Bill of Rights, and it's time for mayors and governors and courts to treat it that way." Wow. I mean, I don't think I could possibly cheer loud enough for that statement in that context.
So what about the newsroom? Do you think that you had mentioned it? Do you think that the newsroom has read that and might even be informing or maybe influenced by some of that?
Well, it's not just that the newsroom and the New York Times needs to read. Like I told you, the story at the New York Times opened with the political angle, but it did include quite a bit of useful information. And frankly, it wasn't as gung-ho Trumpian era politics as I thought it was going to be. Oh, but the coverage in other parts of the country and some of the coverage in broadcasting and some of the coverage that filtered into commentary on Twitter in that acidic pool, we can only hope that there are editors in other parts of the country and other wire services and other national news organizations that I could name. Let's hope they read this. And let's hope that we could get back to the day, maybe this is eschatological thinking and waiting for the second coming of journalism or something, but someday we might be able to see the term religious liberty without scare quotes around it. Because that's essentially what this New York Times op-ed page piece was about. At some point, we need to be able to talk about First Amendment issues as something that affects everybody. Gosh, even those religious people.
With about a minute here, Terry, do you think it would help if, since freedom of the press stands alongside freedom of exercise, would it help if the entire First Amendment, the text of the entire First Amendment, including the free exercise clause, be engraved on the newsroom walls across the country as a reminder to our Fourth Estate?
Well, you know what? I think right now that if you offered that, I mean, of course, the First Amendment was on the front of the museum, the newsium in New York, in Washington, D.C., that unfortunately had to close. I mean, but I think right now we're still at the point where if you offered a beautiful bronze engraved plaque with the entire First Amendment and you offered that to newsrooms across America, a large percent of the editors would still see that as a conservative political statement. But maybe editorials of this kind are the start in chipping away at that blind spot, at that block of ice that's covered this whole subject.
Terry Mattingly is senior fellow at the Overby Center at the University of Mississippi. He is author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and the book Pop Goes Religion, and he's founder and editor of Get Religion. Terry, thank you very much for your time.
Glad to be here again.
When we come back, we're going to talk about an odd juxtaposition of relativism and dogmatism among socially progressive and justice movement types. Dr. R.J. Snell, Director of Academic Programs at the Witherspoon Institute, will be our guest. Advent is a time to reflect, pray, and worship the Christ who came, who comes, and will come again. The Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for December is an Advent devotional booklet called The Jesse Tree. These short daily devotions are filled with symbols, telling the story of Jesus from creation to his second coming. The Jesse Tree is available for only $3. Learn more at issuesetc.org or by calling Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. The Jesse Tree.
Hi, this is Rahema Kavuga, Synod Relations Manager of Lutheran Church Extension Fund. Are you an investor looking to support the bold and loving work of LCMS churches? Is your church or organization ready to do bold and loving work? This year, we have a ripe opportunity to bring Christ to a hurting world. Discover the role you can play in this great work. Call 800-843-5233 or visit lcef.org. That's 800-843-5233, lcef.org.
Learn and grow with us at Redeemer Lutheran Church, 7670 East Jomax Road, Scottsdale, Arizona. The gifts of Christ are received every Lord's Day in the 9 a.m. Divine Service. Confessional, Evangelical, Sacramental, Liturgical. Lutheranism the way it used to be. Lutheranism the way it can be once again. If you're in Scottsdale or in the Phoenix metro region, we'd love to have you visit. And please also visit our website, RedeemerScottsdale.org.
This is Dr. Russell Dawn, President of Concordia University Chicago, with a message for parents, grandparents, and godparents of college-bound children. Concordia Chicago is a distinctive, comprehensive university of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. We're devoted to our Lutheran confession and committed to strong academics. Please encourage your child, grandchild, or godchild to check out Concordia University Chicago at cuchicago.edu.
We love our on-demand listeners. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
When Martin Luther preached the dedication for the Torgau Church, he asserted that nothing else happened in this house but that our dear Lord speak to us and we respond in prayer, thanksgiving, and praise.
Issues, Etc. guest Dr. John Pless.
The same could be said of Concordia Theological Seminary. This is a place where our Lord speaks to us through His Word, and we respond in joyful and thankful confession. We therefore invite you to visit our campus, where the Word of Christ dwells among us richly.
Learn more about studying for the vocations of pastor or deaconess at ctsfw.edu or call 1-800-481-2155. Forming servants in Jesus Christ to teach the faithful, reach the lost, and care for all. Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, ctsfw.edu or 1-800-481-2155.